I'm Christopher Lydon, in search of the books that build character, that suggest meaning, the books that furnish a long life, with Arnold Weinstein, who has taught the masterpieces at Brown University for nearly half a century. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is about fiction mainly for a long lifetime. Morning, Noon, and Night is Arnold Weinstein's new long reflection on the novels of youth and love and decline. Arnold, you write the book for us as readers. I want to know the story of you, the reader, and how this all began in your morning and your noon and your maturity. I want to know about the reader inside this writer. How it happened? Where? Who suggested it?
These are good questions. That's what the night phase is so good at, is that you only then, I think, come into some possession of the shape of your own formation and what mattered most. I think when you're actually young and acquiring your tastes and becoming who you are, you have little sense of the shape that you have or the figure that you cut. In my case, in my morning, I was a dreadful reader. I grew up in Tennessee, in Memphis, where there was very little intellectual stimuli. I was smart. I had nothing but good grades and got into Princeton. But even there, when I went to Princeton, I felt sort of underexcited, understimulated, underresponsive. And I think it, for me, there were two critical and generative moments in my life. One was my junior year in Paris, where I discovered, oddly enough, through French, that I had a voice and that I not only began to love reading, but that I had something to say about it, which nobody at Princeton had really helped me to see. And then when I came back to Princeton with Paris behind me and under my belt, I was much more positioned to really start to blossom as a reader. And I can actually point to two texts and one professor, a brilliant man at Princeton who was sort of legendary for us as undergraduates. His name was Larry Holland. He's dead now. And he taught a course on five American authors, and that was my true exposure to Melville and Faulkner. I'd read a little bit, but I didn't know anything about them. So the two books I want to mention in this regard that I think were really threshold books for me were Melville's Benito Cereno and Faulkner's Sound and the Fury.
Interesting.
What was extraordinary about them is that each one of them, in a sense, could be characterized as the opening of a door that I had never anticipated was there. Each one of them was a opportunity or a discovery that the literary text sort of catapulted you somewhere where you hadn't been prior to reading this book, that it was shedding light or shining a beam on a place that you didn't earlier know was there, and led to the corollary that maybe that's what art's about, is that it creates its own world. These are not independent worlds, but in this case, in both of these instances, I thought there was something very rich about it. In other words, the Melville story is about a benighted American, nice, serenely racist sea captain in mid-19th century who comes across this Spanish ship in great distress, and it's a slave ship, and it's about his series of blunders on board the ship, trying to figure out what's going on.
It's about a rebellion.
Well, he doesn't know that. The brilliance of the story. It's the best whodunit in 19th century literature. He has no idea it's a rebellion. Melville writes it through his perspective, and through his perspective, it's a ship that that needs American know-how. It's a ship that is in disarray. He's surprised that there are so few Spanish sailors on it. He's told that they're not there because the ship experienced storm, scurvy, and then this rather effete aristocratic Spanish captain, that's the title of the story, Cereno, Benito Cereno, is his guide, as it were, and he's very bewildered, the American. He's suspicious of this Spaniard. He's suspicious of Spaniards. There's a xenophobic dimension to this. It's a very self-centered, confident American figure, good-natured, innocent, which is one of Melville's key terms. Innocence invariably gets you in trouble in Melville. because it's usually the flip side of ignorance, but also of arrogance. Maybe that's true for everybody. Maybe Melville didn't put a coinage on that. But this figure he sees, Cyrano, who has this faithful black servant, manservant, Babbo, as he hears the stories, he walks around the ship, he just is consistently frustrated that these people haven't gotten it right, that something doesn't square with the story he's hearing and what he's seeing. And he begins to worry that maybe there is some sort of conspiracy or plot, and that these Spaniards, maybe these Spaniard sailors are not dead. He doesn't see them, but maybe they're lurking behind a corner. And then at one moment, it actually crosses his mind, maybe the blacks are involved. And he figures, no, black people, from his point of view, he compares them to Newfoundland dogs, that they are meant to be menials. They couldn't possibly have done anything untoward. All of this continues until he finally leaves the ship. He promises that he's going to send some help from his own boat. He's been on the ship alone. And at that point, all hell breaks loose. He gets into his own boat that picks him up. And then the captain hops overboard, and then so does Babbo, the servant, into his own small whaling boat. That's when the curtain starts to go up. This was not what he thought. And what he realizes then is that it was, in fact, a slave revolt. The slaves had taken over the ship. Nothing in his culture, nothing in the shaping of his mind prepared him to see that. Now, here's the dimensionality of it. I have come to see this as the story that Melville's title was right. It's the story of Benito Cyrano. It's the story of a man who thought he was a captain, sort of named by God and King to be captain. He thought that black people were also his cargo, his slaves. It was a slave ship. And the entire story is about the masquerade or the charade of this same man acting as a captain instead of being a captain. That's what, of course, has fooled the American. But I think Melville wants you to think, what happens when something that you have never thought was a role, you've thought this was your identity, what happens when you discover that this is a posture, that this can be simulated, it can be aped, and that the man who seems to be the manservant is in fact the captain of the ship, that the black man has taken over the ship. This is wreckage, destroys Cyrano, and it occurs to me that Melville could not have told that story in any direct fashion. That's the dimensionality of it. That's the door that opened. I realize in telling that story of Cyrano, of a man who took his power for granted and is essentially crushed by the awareness that power is theater, that power is role-playing, power is a structure, and power can be, it's a set of props, can be reimagined. I think I learned something about literature, not just about Melville. I also think it's the most cinematic story in the 19th century because you're seeing it through innocent eyes. And one of my, after this last book has been done, now what I'd like to do is to get a movie made out of this because it should be a film.
Would you make it yourself?
I spent a year writing a film script for it. I've tried to interest film people in it. I'm still trying. So I don't know if it's ever going to lead to anything.
But this is fascinating. Did you read Benito Cyrano before Moby Dick? Before Billy Budd? Before?
I read them at exactly the same time. And I came to the view even then that something in it, the theory I gave you of it just now is not what I saw immediately as an undergraduate. I chewed on this. I went to graduate school, continued to think about Melville. It was when I got my job at Brown in the first year or two that it gradually sort of opened up more fully. But I stumbled into it or at it all the way back at Princeton. And as I say, it taught me a lesson about literature. But all the things I've said about it could not be said for Moby Dick. Moby Dick is a far more exuberant, confident, Baroque fiction. It doesn't have this. It doesn't have this extraordinary sort of deconstructing of power, because that's really what it is, that a man comes to realize that he is a ghost. He is ghosted by the plot. And Moby Dick doesn't make the same scathing commentary about American innocence. I read this story as a story about not knowing who is who when you're in a strange place like this American sea captain on the Spanish ship. And I think that's the story of countless American catastrophes. I think of Vietnam, I think of Afghanistan, I think of Iraq, I think of all the ones that are lining up in front of us, maybe Libya, where we don't know who the good guys and the bad guys are. We are not acculturated to read the signs. Melville wrote that story already. He frames it in terms of slavery, but it has very disturbing and I think exciting analogies with sort of continued misadventures in American thinking and even in American foreign policy.
Isn't it amazing? You just get talking about books in 0 to 60, you're at Melville. I mean, from nowhere. I want to go back to the beginning. not to put myself in your class as a reader at all, but it starts out the same. I applied to a school when I was 12 years old, and they asked me to list 7 books I'd read in the last year. I said finally, I just read one book 7 times, and it was Joe DiMaggio's Lucky to Be a Yankee. I was a terrible reader as a kid. Where did it go for you as a kid, sort of in the morning stage? Who were you reading, and when did you decide, now this is the meat of my life, this is the meat of my education?
I was reading things like Joe DiMaggio and sports books in high school, and I was getting straight A's in my English classes, but they were dreadful, the classes. We spent 3 months reading Macbeth, which is what one did in those days. The sort of leaping into a text or realizing the reaches of a text, none of that happened to me until Princeton. When I went off to college, I thought I was going to be a lawyer. Not because I knew the first thing about law, but because that's what kids going to Ivy League schools from Memphis were likely to want to do. I didn't think I wanted to be an investment banker, so very likely law seemed to be a kind of middle-of-the-road thing you could choose. And when I was a senior and was hard-bitten and converted to literature and knew that I was going to go to graduate school and do literature, I remember being with friends in Memphis who all cautioned me and said, you've made a dreadful choice, a tragic choice. You will never be able to have any kind of sort of material comforts in your life. How on earth can you elect a career in the profession? And when I look back on that today, that's what people should be telling undergraduates today who are thinking of going to the academy. Today, you really cannot make your path easily in the academy. The odd thing was that when I heard that in 1958 or 1962, when I finished Princeton, it was the wrong message. In fact, in my generation, it wasn't so hard to get into good graduate schools and to get a job and to have some security.
What is it kids need to be told sailing not necessarily to law school, maybe to Wall Street jobs, about stopping and listening to literature?
They, I think, need to know that reading is not necessarily a professional activity. It's the most, I think of reading as the most basic, among the most basic things you do. I put it on a par with eating and drinking and going to the bathroom and breathing. In fact, and I think that when you think about where reading takes place, it takes place in bed, it takes place when people are sitting in chairs. It doesn't take place when people are standing and working or anything. The reason I compare it to things as basic as eating and drinking is that I think people read for nutrients. They don't know that. This sounds reductive, but it's not. It's as elemental as cannibalism, that you're trying to take from this text something that you need. I think we go through life like that. And we leave the things that don't nourish us, and we stay with the things that do. That definition of a kind of intake of nutrients is something that is a far bigger proposition than whether you're going to be a lawyer or a doctor, or a professor, for that matter. So that it stands you in good stead no matter what you do. We're back again, I think, to this model that I discovered when I was a senior, which is that literature can catapult you into regions or realms that you hadn't known of. It's a workout for the imagination. It's a kind of aerobics that you don't get when you go to a gym. It makes the imagination into something that extends your life and extends your reach into other people's lives. I mean, that's what it meant for me to all of a sudden realize Melville was writing the story of Cereno. He made us understand what this man's undoing was. And he couldn't have told it directly. And that great literature is rarely direct. It makes us think. It makes us feel our way into places that we're not used to being. And I think we always come home with it. I mean, I think it's like bringing home the bread. It becomes part of who we are, part of our own stock. But you have to reach to get there. That's one reason that reading literature through the lenses of Wikipedia, or it used to be Cliff Notes, is such a joke. Because to summarize literary plots is nothing. It's like summarizing yesterday's newspaper. What's interesting in these books is this kind of space and time that I'm talking about, where they take you into a place you haven't been. That resists any kind of empirical notation, but that adds stock to the reader's imagination. And that's good for people, whatever their professional or, you know, material choices are going to be.
Arnold, you're famous for teaching the impossible ones, Proust and Faulkner and Toni Morrison and Hemingway. What got you from Benito Cereno into the whole pool?
Okay. a lot of it, again, goes back to this saintly man who taught me at Princeton when I was a senior. We read 5 Faulkner novels then. Reading The Sound and the Fury changed my life in the same way that Benito Cereno did, partly because I grew up in the South, so the book was not exotic to me. I knew something about the Dilsey figure. I knew from my own background about black women working in families for $2 a week. That was the case in my family. But I also knew something about the sort of curse or condemnation that family is under these Compson sons. And in particular, the most heartbreaking parts of that book are the first 2 parts, the idiot experience, Benji's, and then Quentin, who gets out of the South, it would seem, and gets up to Cambridge, Massachusetts, gets to Harvard, and then commits suicide after his first year. Those 2 parts of that book did something comparable to the Melville. Faulkner had written 3 books before this. But in The Sound and the Fury, Faulkner, as Faulkner, disappears. And instead, we have these 4 blocks of writing. And what he does in those first 2 sequences is that he shows us something that you cannot see with your eyes. You know, the only analogy I have to it is the kinds of night vision that we have in warlike situations where we give these goggles to soldiers and they can see what the retina can't take in at night. In literature, it's something richer than that, is that the novel can show us 2 things at once: how a character operates in a social setting, what he or she says, all the things that anybody there could see, but also what he feels or she feels and thinks. And there's a warfare in The Sound and the Fury. We see the rich inner life of these figures, and it's very dooming. We see how each of them is carrying an amount of garbage with them that's going to destroy them. Well, we see that Quentin is going to go under with all the unresolved issues that he brings with him to Cambridge. It's what I tell my students, that you unpack your clothes and your books when you get to Brown, but there's a lot of stuff that you can't unpack, but you brought with you anyway. It's a different kind of luggage. In this book, the luggage boils over. And Faulkner writes that. He writes it almost as a ballet between the steps that you take in your here and now world. In that case, it's at Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1910, trying to stay afloat. And then the then and there world, which is Quentin's past, his relationship with his sister, which is poisonous. And the same is true for Benji. All of these boys, these 3 Compsons, go under, even though 1 continues to live, or 2 continue to live, because of the loss of love in that family, because of their sister, Caddy, who escaped that family, got herself pregnant, and got out of there. But it's the discovery that I made that the novel can give us that double testimony about inside and outside, about private psyche, and what a historian could tell you about what's happening, the moves that a person makes against a social backdrop. But it's the give and take between those. And I think each one of us lives exactly that ballet. We are always juggling what's going on or roiling inside of us versus the moves or steps that we make in our day-to-day lives or in our public lives, social lives. So Faulkner taught me that. And I feel like when I came to Brown, it was like a mission, like a wedding contract. I was there to teach Faulkner, even more than to teach Melville. Partly because in New England, they think the South is Never Never Land. And it was fun to, since I came, I felt like an ombudsman. I came from that territory. Those books were not, as I said, exotic for me. But I think that once you see past the picturesqueness of Faulkner's world, or the evils of both racism and sexism, which are there in Faulkner's world, that was there in his South, it was there in my South when I grew up. Once you see past that, and you can see past it, then you are confronting an extraordinarily rich picture of human maneuvering room, how you live with your inner ghosts, how you try to reach to the other, and that books in that sense are profoundly ethical. That again is that sort of, I think books are mirrors for readers, but they're not mirrors in the lazy narcissist sense that it's kind of facile self-reflection. It's again, there's labor in it. You realize that it's called a distorting mirror. It's a picture of who you are, but it's perhaps an element or version of you that either you've never noticed or never wanted to notice. And I think Faulkner's, how could it be otherwise? What Emerson called oversoul in one of the essays. He says that any book that you can understand, if you can understand it, it's because some part of you has been there and knows this is true. There's a weird kind of traffic between us and the books that we read, which is a way of saying there's so much more in us than we know about, and that books help us recover and possess.
Didn't Emerson say the book is reading you?
The book is reading you. The book is reading you. There's a question that I've always liked. A friend of mine who was at the Shakespeare Society in New York said she was always asked, how much do you know about Shakespeare? And she was not a scholar. And she said, not nearly as much as he knows about me. And that's true for any great book. And of course, it's counterintuitive. Like one says, well, what on earth could Shakespeare, you know, who died many, many centuries ago, know about me? You know, Harold Bloom said the same thing, that we know more about Hamlet than we know about our best friends. He probably could have argued about ourselves.
Harold Bloom loves to quote that Emerson line that when you read a great masterpiece infinitely beyond your own understanding, you still find your own thoughts coming back through the text, as he says, with a certain alienated majesty.
That's beautifully put.
Can I just digress to the subject of Proust, which you also teach? I worry sometimes that your method isn't telling kids that this is about you, kids. Proust wrote it to explain you to yourself, when in fact he's also unveiling a profoundly almost otherwise unimaginable universe of feeling. And
he is. When I teach the Proust, Joyce, and Faulkner course, which is one of my favorite courses here, Proust is, of course, extremely distant to them. He's writing about the antics of a late 19th century aristocratic and upper middle class culture that they know nothing about. And he's also writing about such an egomaniacal figure that they don't want, I think, to see that as any kind of a mirror figure at all. It's also the most profoundly solipsistic picture of human life that we have in literature, because the vision that Proust offers us there is that we can never go outside of our own feelings or our own thinking or our own notions. I mean, there's a subjectivity in Proust that is, in a sense, carceral. It's penitential. It says you never get beyond this. And that he has a famous quote saying that the person who says that he does get beyond this is lying. So that the ramifications for this are hideous. The human relationship is a fiction. Knowing the world and knowing others is probably a fiction. Where this gets, I think, in some sense, salvaged is that, and this too is not always pretty, is that others are also, like books, conduits to a deeper self-knowledge. You have to be sort of comfortable in the fact that you're always coming back to yourself. And a lot of people aren't, because we have a religious tradition that essentially codes that as either selfish or evil. But I think that you've got to at least tentatively bracket that when you read Proust. Once you do bracket that, and any honest, thoughtful person knows that they live largely within themselves, once you do bracket that, then Proust really becomes awfully persuasive. I don't think, in my experience in teaching Proust, that students come to me and say, you know, none of this makes sense, or all of this is sort of counter to my take on things. They often say, this is counter to what I'd like to believe life is about, or this is counter to what I think my relationships are or what I want them to be. In that sense, I think Proust is tonic. I certainly never answer, you're wrong and Proust is right. But I do say that read him, because he at least, it seems to me, calls the bluff on our facile notions that there's a great interstate highway between us and others, and all we have to do is get in our car and turn on the motor and we're there. I think he suggests that exiting the self is something of a fiction, that even the deepest investments that we have with other people, we bring ourselves with us, or our take on them is inalterably cued to who we are. It does have some, I think, undeniable truth, even in the deepest human relationships and arrangements. And I think Proust, he's not a policeman, but I think he reminds us of those dark facts.
Arnold Weinstein, you remind me of a moment. I was watching a student unpack books on a window shelf at Harvard, and I was just struck by the titles. I mean, it was Middlemarch, William Carlos Williams, Invisible Man, a great range of things. Raymond Carver stories, and I said, well, those are sort of all the books you need for a lifetime. And the girl said, no, that's Robert Coles' reading list for a course called, it was known as Guilt 101, but the name of it in the book was The Literature of Social Reflection, taught by that famous psychiatrist, doctor, social activist. And it was a hugely popular course at Harvard. And I ended up teaching three semesters as a section person in it. But also at Yale, meantime, Harold Bloom teaches a course on how to read a poem, and he writes books like, you know, What to Read and Why, or Where Will Wisdom Be Found? In each of those three cases, not to mention your brother, who teaches a course something like this at Swarthmore, we have men, American men, not far from 70, giving American undergraduates this kind of priceless list of sort of, here's food for your life, here's food for your mind. And I thought, wow, how marvelous. I've seen it up close. But how did this happen? How does it work? It should be required maybe in colleges all over the country. But to what extent are you all doing the same thing?
Not really, but we are also. I think that since I'm a twin, I know something about sameness and difference. From any perspective other than mine, people cannot easily distinguish between my twin brother and me. He writes on Faulkner. We each give a course called Proust, Joyce, and Faulkner.
Wow.
Since I come to this from the inside, I know how completely different we are, although we are very, very close and very intimate, but that our take on things is different. He's much more interested in modern theory. I'm probably closer to Bloom in that regard, anti-theory, or I don't think I call it the school of resentment, but I'm suspicious of theory. What I am saying is that sameness and difference, I don't teach the way Bloom teaches, as far as I can tell. I know something about his books, and I've heard stories from you, and I've heard stories from students of mine who've gone to Yale. What grounds your suspicion that there's something the same in all of these is that it's carrying out not just a tradition, but an injunction, it seems to me, that says that we're part of an ongoing life. They're young, we're 70, and these books, in many cases, are centuries old. And there's a kind of parallel between the bloodline in students, the bloodline in faculty, and the bloodline in books, that we are there to keep these alive. There is no single finite list. In all of my courses, for example, I try to put together a mix of canonical books and at least some that I don't think the students have ever heard of. The only requirement being that I think all of them have this kind of reach that I've articulated.
So does Robert Coles, for that matter. Walker Percy, the moviegoer, is a, should we say, a minor classic, but it's a big center of his reflection. Tilly Olson's stories. William Carlos Williams, not his poetry, but his doctor stories. His experience as a...
They're wonderful stories, those doctor stories. Very tight-lipped, but wonderful anyway, I think.
From a guy who made house calls as
writing all that poetry. Hard to believe. Yeah. Well, that's a rich tradition of writer-doctors. It goes back to Chekhov. It goes back earlier than that, probably. I teach a course in literature and medicine, and most of the students are pre-meds, and it's usually the only humanities course they teach. It's one of the glories of the American liberal arts model, is that you can actually get people who are going to be doctors to do a literature course. And, of course, in this material, I have them read Kafka. I have them start with Sophocles, but I also have them read Richard Seltzer. And it's kind of interesting how a man who opens the human body, and he writes about these matters, says that you can look at the blood, you can look at the organs, you can look at the bones, but you cannot look at it all because you can't see it. His thoughts, feelings, sensations, whether you call it psyche or soul, everything else that's inside of that body. I'm sure that's one of the main reasons why he writes, is that he wants to get at that other side of the human subject, which is a human object. And there's something quite complementary in studying it both ways, you know, physiologically, but also verbally, and also just through his imagination.
What does it add to the mix that a lot of the professors we're talking about are drawing on a kind of Jewish experience, Jewish imagination, Jewish history.
That's I'm going to answer it with an anecdote, which is a real one in my life, that like many 16-year-olds when I was growing up in Memphis, I took an aptitude test. And the aptitude test showed that I was not cut out for being a forest ranger, which I agreed with. And it said that what I was likely going to be was a rabbi. And I laughed and laughed, and my twin brother got the same result. And we both laughed forever. We were not religious, observant. I'm still not. And I laughed about it for so many years until it occurred to me that that's what I've become, that a rabbi is a person who, in fact, interprets texts for a community. That's what the tradition was about. And the day that that dawned on me, that I, in fact, am a secular rabbi, not that I'm trying to prescribe behavior, but that I'm standing there interpreting texts and trying to show people that they matter, there's got to be something Jewish in it. I don't think the Jews have a lock on this, but maybe that's the Jewishness of what I do, and maybe that's the Jewishness of what people like Bloom and others do. I don't know.
Arnold Weinstein, come back to the morning, noon, and night of your own reading, your own discovery in reading, not just what you're teaching. Where did you land with passion as the embodiment of sort of man reading?
I guess, in a sense, my late noonday, I don't want to call it my night yet because that I can still talk about as something still later, but I think the pivotal moment in my career had to do with the opportunity to give courses for this outfit called the Teaching Company, which meant that I was flown to their studio in Washington, and I produced a bunch of courses, some 200-plus lectures, that were seen and listened to around the country in audio or video or DVD form, CDs. And all of a sudden, I had an audience beyond the specific Brown University audience that I'd been accustomed to. And it radically changed the way I saw myself as a reader, above all, how I saw myself as a speaker about literature, because I was talking to lay people exclusively then, not even to Brown University students, which is already a fairly elite group. I had to start to cleanse my vocabulary of the academy, which was very hard. It's at that point that I began to, in a much more self-conscious way, pitch what I had to say for people who were not professionals, which is something that I think that most people in the academy are never required to do. And I think that's what's often narrow about the academy, is that we talk to ourselves and that we write our books for our own specialist peers. And it's one reason that the academy, I think, is sort of suspicious in the eyes of many people in the lay public. But literature should not be held hostage to that elitist model. I mean, literature, is, as I said, is about eating and drinking, and it's about basic elemental functions. And so I learned to do that, and I think it changed my teaching. My courses became broader. They became more personal. They became more conversational. I hope I didn't, you know, sign off my brains at the door, because I don't think there's any tug of war between remaining analytic and disciplined and at the same time trying to cast what you have to say to people who are not going to be professionals.
Who were the writers you were reading, and what were you drawing out of them?
I was reading a lot of the same writers. You can't change the canon. I did not change from one group to another. But I found myself talking about more meat and potatoes issues in these books. For example, I was teaching Othello, and I'd always read Othello it was taught to me as the war sort of between Iago and Othello, these two sort of honchos having it out, which model was going to persevere. And I remember learning from a colleague about feminist issues in Othello, that in fact, and it taught me to see that maybe the real strong figure of that play is Desdemona. And I thought that's worth talking about to an audience that has, particularly, of course, in literature, is going to have more women students than men, that she's the one who absolutely challenges male authority, the father who thought he owned her and then the husband who thought he owned her. It occurs to me that in the books that I teach, there are a lot of very basic kinds of issues that don't need to be theorized, that are on people's plates. I thought about Iago even, that Iago is the one that students inevitably identify with. And a colleague of mine once said, his is the discourse of intelligence. And it occurred to me, that's the key virtue at Brown, is intelligence. It's a key virtue in the American university. It's a key virtue in our society. Now, notice that we're using the word virtue. What we tell people is that virtue is a moral proposition. It's an ethical proposition. No one got into Brown, I think, on the strength of their ethics and their morals. They got in on the strength of their intelligence. I'm not saying that people at Brown are like Iago. What I'm saying is that that play measures how far you go with brains and brains alone, and that brains may have little to do with values or with a sort of traditional moral compass. Iago is a terrifying figure. I think Shakespeare knew that. Bloom thinks that Iago is one of the great fiendish creations in literature. But I like the parallel between that and the kinds of things that my students have done to get into Brown. The SAT scores have little to do with virtue. They have little to do with kindness. We tell people that we want you to be a decent moral person in life. But in fact, the elite institutions in this country take a totally different measure. And that's equally true, I think, in professional life. So there's a real gap there between the kind of noises that we make and what we actually measure. I think Shakespeare's play tells us a lot about that.
You got through college, as I did, before theory raised its beautiful head. We learned to read books for either aesthetic pleasure or kind of emotional connection or kind of instruction. I think of Dostoevsky, for example, who my youngest brother read him before I did, but he fell in love with the idea of Alyosha, a young aspiring idealist and teacher and servant. And at the time he was reading it in high school, he used to walk around with that book on his heart, literally month after month. And that itself is what I remember first about Dostoevsky. This was before literature was deconstructed or gendered or run through every kind of modern filter. I often wonder, frankly, what am I missing for want of Foucault's advice on all of these books?
I'm afraid I'm on your side of the ledger here. Fortunately, I have tenure and they can't take it away from me. I think that today's academy, as well as yesterday's, and pretty much in the wake of our own years, I think from the 70s on, that's what the professional study of literature has emphasized. Theory, whether it's Foucault, whether it's Lacan, whether it's cultural studies, whether it's the new historicism. I think sometimes that none of these people did enough model airplanes when they were young, and therefore they can't, you know, they can't resist the idea of talking about one model or another instead of reading, as you put it, for emotion, or even better, holding the book as your brother did next to your heart. You know, which is a kind of cardiac remark, that it's as if the blood pumping in your heart and the blood pumping in a book are of the same sort, that they are, at least there's something that's parallel there. I also think that the students who come our way want that older picture of what literature offers, why one reads. And in fact, that's how they come to the university, that they have read that way. They've not been exposed to theory in high school. And it's why, and this is a tragedy that is never, ever addressed, it's why, particularly at the best universities in America, legions of people stop taking literature courses. Legions of people discover...
What do you think?
I do indeed. I think that they come in, they are exposed to the first literature course at the university. They get this huge dosage of high theory, and they say to themselves, this is not the way it was taught to me earlier. I did not sign on for Foucault. I signed on for Shakespeare. And I think many of them take the view that the kinds of pleasures that they experience or the kind of excitement they experience is not likely to be forthcoming in this new scheme. We don't have numbers for this. We never measure the things that don't happen. So we don't know how many people should have been literature majors. Needless to say, it's not the best way to get a job either. But I think one of the great luxuries of the American university is that you can major in something you like, and there should be many more people majoring in literature than do. So I think the problem with theory is that we've become obsessed with reading literature as a kind of blueprint about power. The arrogance in this is stupefying, because it's somehow assumed that the professor himself has this diagnostic gaze and knows how power works. But frequently the tone of much literary criticism is how benighted the author was. He or she did not realize that he or she was a tool either of late-stage capitalism or of particular gender arrangements or particular arrangements about the culture and the society at large. And so we read the book frequently with the view of correcting its lenses and explaining how either the characters or the author couldn't have been expected to get it right. That's the arrogance I'm talking about, because that's how people will be reading us probably in 20 or 30 years. We're going to look as benighted as they do. The professors certainly do not have a position that's panoptic. But I also think that students, there's more to life than power. And there's more to books than politics and ideology. I think that that would be heretical, that remark, for many of my colleagues who think that all we're supposed to be studying is the composition of ideology and of power. People have said anybody who's anti-theory is kidding themselves, because you can't simply read the books, is what I've seen it expressed.
Right.
You're always reading according to the lens of one theory or another. But to me, that's like saying everything you see is going through the lens that constitutes your eyes. Okay, that doesn't mean we still have to talk about lenses all the time. We can still talk about what we perceive, knowing that it's constructed, knowing that it's mediated. But do we have to get totally hung up on all of these mediations, or can we actually nonetheless try to talk about the books? Susan Sontag's first book was called Against Interpretation. And what she said there is, we've got altogether too much interpretation. We don't have enough experience. We don't have enough firsthand encounter with art. Can we possibly get the interpretive lens off the table for a minute, stop focusing or worrying about that, and actually try to have a direct encounter with the thing? And the theorist can reply, well, that's impossible. My answer would be, but that's where the fun is. And that's what most students, in fact, think that they're doing. We in the academy love to explain to them that it's far more complicated than that, but I'd rather tell them that it's richer than that, that you reading a book is going to be a series of explosions in both sides.
Orhan Pamuk, the Turkish novelist, gave a series of lectures a year or two ago, now a book. He tells a story quite like yours of, as he said, reading novels in his teenage years and his early 20s especially, furnishing his mind, discovering his soul, getting essential liquids for life, as he put it. Back to your own story, even currently, of the places where you as a grown-up, found the proteins of your mind. And does it continue?
I hope it continues. Faulkner once said that breathing is a sight draft dated yesterday. So that, we may have tenure at the academy, but we don't have tenure for our brain. But I think that for me, reading is inseparable from both writing and teaching, which gives me great pause when I think about retirement, which I think about. In as much as, yes, Pamuk says that these are the furnishings, that was the way you characterized it, of his mind. I often find that as a surprise. I find it, but I am shocked occasionally to realize that my way of looking at life is not necessarily mine. It's what has been put in me by the books that I've read and loved, and that I think that they're mine. And in a sense, they are mine. I have first personalized the books that I have read, but I also find that there is a very hard to measure two-way traffic that goes on. I find, for example, when I write about books, I'm stunned at what I write. I do not use outlines. I do not even know what I'm going to say about books until I start writing. It's often the case even when I talk about books.
Really?
I think it's because I must be very censored to myself. There must be a lot of parts of me that are off limits to my conscious volitional mind. So I find that books trigger things in me. And when I write about the books or speak about the books, they send me back into the books, but they also send me beyond the books. And I ascribe that to the books. What I said about Benito Sereno, saying that it ultimately tells us something about our mistakes in wars,
right,
in the 20th century in America, in the 21st century, we certainly know Melville couldn't have intended that. No Melville scholar would say that this is legitimate. And yet, for me, that's the afterlife of that book. That's its further flowering. And it came about through this kind of strange backing and forthing between me and a text. And it has to do with my talking about these texts. It has to do with my suspicion, as I said, of outlines, because that's only a logical framework, whereas books are never just logical frameworks. I don't like the way we teach writing for just that reason, that students come into my courses knowing they're supposed to say thesis, body of argument, and conclusion. That's a sterile way of proceeding. Certainly, Benito Sereno blows it sky high Why not tell something instead that is wrong, benighted, erroneous, and then get to the truth? That's closer to the way we go through life anyway. But, you know, we go through in the dark and we momentarily achieve light. I'd like to see reading understood that way. Every time I go back to a book and I see my underline, sometimes I realize I don't agree with the things that I wrote then. Sometimes I say to myself, I wish I were as smart now as I was then, because I can't get to that same viewpoint now. So books that you have written in that you return to are weird maps of who you are. They're better than diaries because they have these repeated returns where they are kind of, you know, text of your own evolution. But one of the books that I love to teach is Knud Hamsun's book, Hunger, about a starving writer. And in that, he talks about being sort of in a moment of great enthusiasm in the old-fashioned sense of the word, where the words just explode. They come to him like in a trance. And he's sitting there desperately, and he's a journalist. He's not as much as a writer. And he's trying to capture these words. And the words are coming faster than he can write. And I think to myself, that's why Plato banned the poets, that the poets themselves are subject to these fits of enthusiasm instead of following the dictates of logic as the philosopher understood it. And therefore, they are not to be trusted. And the poets are people for whom this enthusiasm comes in the form of these words, and words themselves are not to be trusted. It's instead the form of things that he must have thought was truest. What I think is fascinating about Hamsun is that the words do come first. And the words tell us what they mean. We follow the words. In a sense, this interview is that. I haven't plotted everything that I'm saying. That the words lead me as much as me leading them. And I think that the richest things that I have to say are often going to be that untrammeled. In a sense, when I go in front of a classroom several days a week for year after year after year, what I try to do is untie myself. Because I don't think I'm going to start leaking on them or anything. I untie myself so that I can, in fact, have as untrammeled a reach into myself. That's what a lifetime of reading does. I prepared those things. They are prepared. When I am most spontaneous, it's because I'm digging deepest into the things that I've been thinking about. But I can't easily just call them up by an outline or say, now, in part 3D, this comes into the mix. Instead, I want part 3D or part 3E to be a kind of moment that's generative, that brings me further into my own materials. When I have finished what I think is a good lecture, it's because I said things that surprised me.
Arnold Weinstein, you began with Benito Cereno. Who's the Benito Cereno that you're marveling at, that you're resorting to, that you're consoling yourself with or taking new inspiration from today?
Melville is a hard act to follow.
You've done a lot of reading since then, though.
Well, I've done a lot of reading, and I try to stay at least halfway up with what's being written. One of the authors who does intrigue me is the South African writer Coetzee, and I think that Disgrace is one of my favorite books there. It's an uncomfortable book. It's about a professor who comes on to his female student who's 30 years younger. That's an event that happens all too often in the academy. He is the child, in some ways, of romantic literature. He's trying to write a biography of Byron. He quotes Blake in justifying his actions about following desire. And the reason he interests me now, that book does, and why it's called Disgrace, is that, you know, part of his disgrace is obvious and professional. He's going to be sacked at the university for having this affair, or forcing himself, quasi-raping this young girl. But the larger disgrace, he comes to understand, is the disgrace of living in time and living in a body. And Freud said of Lear that it's the necessity of making friends with dying. And I think that at my age of 70, that's what I have to think more and more about. It's not a happy thought. It's a hard friendship to make friends with dying. And that book is larded with the perceptions that there's a time when you have to exit the party, or when you have to leave the feast, or when you have to make friends with dying, or you have to realize that they're the young who have their place, and that you have to learn how to let go of some things. That's the last lines of Disgrace. I'm letting him go. I'm giving him up is actually what it's written about, this animal that he's caressing, that this dog that loves him, and now this dog who was injured is going to be put away and put to death, and he will let it go. And letting go is whatever wisdom of old age should consist of. At least that's one piece of it. But other writers that are old age writers that are My Benito Serenos are the old faithful, like Proust. I read Proust against himself. I think Proust is the great egomaniac of literature because he's the great truth teller about living in the self and not exiting it. But truth, the argument about time that is in Proust, that we have such an unimaginative sense of the temporal dimensions of our life. We know something about the spatial dimensions. Mm. We know about the places we've been, the trips we've made, but we almost, because memory itself is a sieve, particularly my memory is, that it's locked into the here and now. We can remember, you know, only, you know, scarcely the things that happened yesterday or last year. And when we look in scrapbooks, we can't really recall that person. We know it was true, but we can't relive that person. Proust's book is essentially an effort to recapture this incredibly sort of full dimensional temporal self that every human life is. That, in a way that Proust does not argue, that nonetheless is an ethos. If we could see people, loved ones, children, parents, but even friends and even enemies, as temporally dimensional, as having a past, as having a future, as having many chapters in their lives, you can't see it with your eye. We're condemned to a snapshot, retinal, ocular picture of everything that we encounter. Mm. If we could project that onto it, it consoles us. When I think of my dying mother and how she looked, I knew what she looked like when she was dying and senile. I wish I could have remembered more vividly when she was a young mother, and even the pictures I have of when she was young before I was born. I wish I knew how to add that. That's the Proustian picture. Mm. That's the fuller plenitude of any life. I think old people, because they have gone a long time, should be more capable. The young are almost never capable of this. Should be more capable of that. I call it in my book fourth dimensional vision. We should be. I think Shakespeare has some sonnets about things like this.
Yeah.
To learn to see people in time, and we used to say, "Are you going to get here in time?" You know, to make an appointment. But to see people in time is a remarkable phrase if you think about it. If you could see them in their trajectory of time. So, in a sense, those issues are sort of tidings of sorts that make sense for me at this point that I tried to sound, you know, in this last book, and that even to very young people, those who I teach who are five decades younger than me, those are things worth talking about.
Arnold Weinstein, you're very generous with us. You tell us a lot about books. You told us a lot about yourself. What more could we ask? Thank you. And let us come back, please.
Thank you. This was a great pleasure. It's fun to have this kind of exchange.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.